Welcome back to Rightscast, a podcast from the Human Rights Centre at the University of Essex. In this episode, we bring you a panel discussion with members of Amnesty International's Crisis Response Team, as they provide insight into how they use remote and open source tools to support their on-the-ground investigations into some of the world's most serious conflicts, and how these investigations can be translated into effective human rights advocacy. In this episode, you will hear from Brian Kastner, Senior Advisor and Military and Weapons Expert on the Crisis Response Team, Scott Edwards, Senior Advisor for Tactical Research and Analysis, Micah Farfour, Special Advisor in Remote Sensing, Richard Pierce House, Head of Crisis and the Environment, and Donatella Rivera, Senior Crisis Response Advisor.
All right, well, maybe then we could start from the outside in, and if you could just maybe tell us who you are and a little bit about what you do, just to get a bit of an insight.
Sure. So my name is Brian Kastner. I'm the weapons and military expert on the crisis team. I usually call myself the bomb guy, so I don't have a traditional human rights background. I was in the U.S. military, did a couple tours in Iraq, became a contractor and a journalist, and that's what eventually led me to Amnesty. So I'm doing a couple things. I'm doing a lot of the physical evidence or the analysis of what weapons are specifically used in each war crime or human rights abuse, and then trying to tie that to a perpetrator as much as possible to be able to say that, you know, for example, there's a lot of bombings in Yemen, for instance, to be able to say, well, the weapon that hit this house and killed these 12 people is an American weapon, called a particular thing a GBU-12. It was this size. It was made on this day. It was sold from the U.S. government to the Saudis on a particular day. And so that way we can establish, you know, culpability, or at least it's one strand of evidence to be able to do that. Nothing that I discover is conclusive, but it usually, you know, can lead us into kind of an interesting direction. There's other ways to be able to establish that. You can look at uniforms, what different police unit, the badges, the different camouflage patterns. Can try to establish whether in a particular military action, if it was reasonable for that unit to take a certain actions at a certain time, or if it was unreasonable, and so then, you know, it's a human rights abuse. So being able to figure out just, you know, I guess I'm a little bit of the military whisperer for Amnesty, to be able to say this is how military officers think, and so this is we can maybe establish why certain things happen.
Scott Edwards, Senior Crisis Advisor. Explaining what I do is not going to be as pithy as the bomb guy. I guess if I had to put a label on it, I am the team social scientist. Not that most teams have social scientists on them. The crisis team itself is a multidisciplinary team, but the evidence lab is a smaller subset of it where we can bring in expertises, where we're sort of mandated to help increase the accuracy, the speed, and the completeness of Amnesty's reporting, and specifically on crises. And that really goes to leveraging new investigatory techniques, new analytic techniques. What my function is largely to bring insights from various academies into human rights defense. So constantly striving to improve the means and methods by which we do investigations. Historically, Amnesty's been an engine for really innovating in human rights investigations. You know, notably the use of remote sensing and GIS, as well as the creation of some of the methods that those of you who are involved with the DBC would use. So I'm often a scientist whisperer, much in the same way Brian's a military whisperer, helping connect advances in data collection, analytics, strategic thinking and modeling for human rights defense.
So my name is Micah Farfour.
I work with the crisis team under the evidence lab with Scott and Brian. I am their remote sensing specialist. So I use a lot of satellite imagery to work with the researchers and other people within the organization to document human rights abuses from space. I am not a lawyer. I didn't really know that much about human rights when I came in, but I did have an interesting background in working with former CIA and FBI under Ventor to understand how to use satellite imagery to understand what you're seeing on the ground.
Hello, my name is Richard Pierce House. I'm head of crisis and environment inside the crisis response team. As you will guess, the concept of what is a crisis is fairly big and broad, and the concept of what is the environment It's pretty big and broad. If we're honest about climate change, it is a huge environmental crisis, and we accept that it's a climate emergency. But there's also something that's overwhelming about that. It's going to paralyze you, and you're stuck, and what are we meant to do about that? And so part of what I try and do is to break it down into concretely, these are lines of research and lines of advocacy that we can do inside that big crisis. We sort of try and make it into smaller crises, bite-sized crises that we can work on and try and fix.
My name is Donatella Rivera. I'm one of the crisis investigator in the crisis response program. And my job is to generally deploy to situation of armed conflict or other crisis situation to investigate human rights violations, war crimes, crimes against humanity committed by both state and non-state actors during conflict and after conflict. I do that primarily in the Middle East and Africa.
So, Brian, well, maybe you could talk us a little bit through how you go about a field visit. And I think one of the things that would be interesting for everybody here is to know if there's anything that when they do investigations that they should be doing to make your life easier.
Oh, yeah, that's interesting. So field visits, before I talk much about field visits, let me say that actually, like most human rights investigations now, I don't go to the field for everything. Most of us work remotely. Partly it's an access issue. A lot of the countries don't want to let us into the places where we do these investigations. And so, I mean, I'm spending as much time looking at video and photos and everything else as we do in a lot of things, except I'm just looking at a very specific piece of it, and that's the weapon aspect of it. When I do go to the field, you know, we had kind of a neat project. Donatella and I went to Libya recently, and something that we were able to do this time that we aren't always able to do is that DVC students were able to look at a whole bunch of videos from the conflict in Tripoli before we arrived, and were able to verify certain videos, to geolocate those videos, to say, well, this thing happened in this place. Sometimes we had names of victims already. Oftentimes, at least we had like a picture, and it's, you know, an apartment block on fire. And so when Donatella and I get there 3 months later, well, there's the apartment block and it's burned. And I recognize it from a video that, you know, DVC students saw. And then that gives us just tremendous leads where from that I can then take it to the next step where I'm, you know, I can go to the crater, the place where the thing blew up, and dig in the crater and pull out physical evidence that's still there. You know, it can be a month or two, but nobody else has dug in the crater yet. It's like you get in there with the gravel, you pull the stuff out, and then because of my background, being a bomb technician is what I used to do in the military, I can identify, okay, well, this is this kind of bomb, this is this kind of rocket, whatever the case may be. I had kind of an interesting duality of missions in a very short period of time, right? We went to Libya in Tripoli in August, and then in September did a mission to Hong Kong. And in some ways, those could not be more different, not just geography and everything else, but like the whole world is paying attention to Hong Kong. No one's paying attention to Libya. And I think that's part of what we do, too, is try to, you know, civilians are dying in lots of places that don't make the news every night. So in those ways, it's very different. The amount of media in both places is different. The types of weapons that the police are using in Hong Kong are very different than the old artillery. We were finding artillery rounds. I found one that was Italian from the 1930s. You know, so like some stuff has just been in Libya for a really long time. So it's a real, I don't know, contrast doing those two things. But in both cases, you know, the whole point of sending somebody like me or sending any investigator, it's not just the testimonies, whatever, it's what physical evidence we can bring back. The point isn't to like find the stuff like, gee whiz, isn't it cool that that they're using this thing or that thing or this mortar or whatever else. It only matters when you're able to say, okay, well, this tear gas grenade was sold by the U.S. to Hong Kong in this year, or this particular guided missile that we saw in Tripoli is Chinese and came from a drone operated by the Emiratis, and there's a U.N. arms embargo. And so this weapon should not be here at this time. It's a, you know, that's a violation. No matter what it hit, even this weapon being in this country is a problem. And so what I'm looking for is something that really adds to our case that the arms embargo needs to be respected. Obviously, one of our standard ones is that you should stop trying to kill civilians. You should, you know, not be carrying out these various attacks. And instead of just saying, well, these attacks are just generally a problem, we can say more specifically, well, this kind of weapon is really inaccurate. There's no way you should be using this weapon in any city ever. And instead of just saying, well, we know somebody died, but we don't know how, we can be really specific and saying the use of this weapon at all in this place is a problem.
How do you actually tell what a weapon is or trace it back to the different people?
Yeah, so sometimes, you know, the Americans are really good about putting lots of very specific data on the back of their bombs, which, and some of those fins survive. And some of you may have seen it. There's manufacture dates. There's codes that say who made it. There's codes that say what specific part it is, and you can cross-reference some of that stuff. I think what's interesting about weapons is a lot of times what it is printed on it. It's like stamped in the metal. You can tell what it is. Like, weapons don't lie. And when they're counterfeit or forged or scratched off or altered, you can usually tell. And so in some ways, it's evidence that you can't argue about, you know, or they can argue if they want. But like, if this artillery round says stamped in at 155 millimeter, whatever else that Donatella brings back from Raqqa, and it's only the U.S. Marines firing that, we're not going to have an argument about who killed the people in this house. I think having that kind of like physicality, I mean, that's what draws me to it as well. But it's also, yeah, it gives me something to look for and be able to find these little unique features on every weapon to differentiate and say, I can't do it all the time. But many times you can say, yeah, it's definitely this. And that's why it's a problem.
Donatella, maybe you could talk us through what it's like bringing the weapons back to the airport.
Yeah. Well, it was remarkably easy not so many years ago. It says not so anymore. But so just in terms of what we do, there is the whole work that we do before we deploy, the preparation, which is both about the substance, all the research that we do beforehand, and colleagues like Micah, Brian are a big part of it, the whole evidence lab, and then the logistics preparation. And the logistics, it's about, you know, drivers and accommodation and security risk. And the two things are not separate. I mean, in the ideal world, you have, you'll have a driver who knows how to get fuel that's not going to destroy the car, and the car will continue working and will also be a trustworthy person. And sometimes it's not as simple as that, and you kind of have to work around those issues. And then there is the in the preparation stages, you know, what we're preparing to go and do, how we want to do it, and what we want to do with the information that we will find. So to start having an advocacy aims, not just research and investigation for the sake of it. Deployment to the ground can be a first or can be one of many. So for example, if I think of the last two deployments in the past year, it's been northern Syria, Raqqa specifically, and Libya. And so these are not currently new situation. In Libya, there has been a cycle of violent confrontation, armed conflict for the past 8 years. And this is sort of the latest conflict within the conflict, with many elements which are very similar to what's been going on for the past years. The work that I did in Syria was very different because I'd been to investigate at the beginning of the conflict in Syria in 2012, but the kind of issues that I've been working on recently in Raqqa was a very different subset of issues. So it was specifically looking at the impact on civilians of the operation, military operation that was led by the US, the coalition, mostly air and artillery campaign that destroyed much of the city and killed many civilians. And what we do when we get to the ground, it's looking at material evidence. Is not just testimonies. I mean, I always say that testimonies can be 100% true, 100% false, and everything in between. So, getting into those craters and getting the pieces so that we can take photos of them and send them to Brian so that he can tell us what it is, where particular fragments came from. Sometimes we work in situation where that's not possible. Raqqa is a good example. There is no way that we could have done what Brian and I did in Libya. It was just too contaminated with unexploded ordnance and mines. So I spent a lot of time in scrapyards looking at what people were bringing back by way of metal that they, you know, that they were selling to scrapyards, and found a lot of interesting stuff by way of remains of munitions. The importance of getting to the ground early cannot be understated. I mean, when it's possible to go, because in a situation of armed conflict, things can change very quickly. Either we lose access, so a place where we could get in today, we may not be able to get in tomorrow. Another strike can completely destroy the evidence from a previous strike. So, for example, I'm thinking years back, I investigated a case of 9 men who were extrajudicially executed by being shot against the wall in a room in a house in a village in northern Syria. Today, all is left of that is the testimony of the people and what I was able to get from that room, the photograph that really complete the story told by the testimony. That physical evidence is long gone. That village has been almost completely destroyed, certainly the house. So things can get destroyed by other strike, or some of the parties to the conflict may have an interest in tampering with the evidence, removing it, adding things, moving. So that's why timing is of the essence. Testimonies, different types of testimonies, what I call testimonies of interest parties, so people who survived, eyewitnesses, family members, but then there is all those around who don't have a stake in the story and who may be more neutral. So it's all of that together, as well as taking the testimonies and looking for material evidence. We have to think about what we want to do with that information. So, depending on how we want to visualize the findings of our work. If we are thinking particularly, with an advocacy strategy that we need particular material for, then we want to do it while we're there because we may not have another opportunity to go back.
How do you explain what you do to people when you're interviewing them in terms of what the information will be used for and, I guess, to manage expectations about what can be achieved by giving you an interview or by giving you pieces of evidence?
Well, first of all, we operate in situation where needs are enormous and not very well met. So outsiders are often presumed to be people who come and bring some material help. So one of the most frequent questions are, how can you concretely help? So it's very, very important to explain to people exactly what we do, the fact that our work may not be of benefit to them personally in the short term, or maybe not even in the long term, but that we are aiming to document with a view to put pressure in order to push for those violations to stop. If it's we're working in a situation of an ongoing conflict, or if it's, after the conflict has ended, in the pursuit of justice for the victims and accountability for the perpetrator. And so that lessons can be learned, so that maybe what has happened to them is not going to be repeated for other civilians. And I must say that by and large, with rare exceptions, people do want to tell what has happened to them. And even if they understand that there isn't going to be any particular benefit to them or any concrete benefit to them in the short term, very often people will not want to be on camera, and we're not media, so that is not strictly necessary for us, but many people will. There will be time when people will accept to be on camera, but we will make the decision that in any case, we don't think that it would be safe for us to show their faces, so we find other ways. But it's worth taking the time to explain to people the limitation of what we do, i.e. the fact that we are not bringing some concrete humanitarian aid for them, because that's too often the presumption.
Scott, what are the type of techniques that you adopt, or how do you decide what to use?
It's fitness for purpose, and that's, to be honest, with the exception of a few very broad, generalizable areas of information technology, such as remote sensing, the techniques that we'll bring in is going to depend on the context we're dealing with, which is not my way of trying to dodge your question. But
I'll move on.
Well, certainly what it is, it's a mixture of being adaptive in our field collection and how we're going about documenting things in the field beyond traditional testimony. And what other data is out there, either in the open source or the larger realm of big data that we can use to figure out the who, what, where, and when, both for our reporting, but hopefully, as Donatella mentioned, down the road, accountability mechanisms.
So you mentioned it's kind of on a case-by-case basis, but when you started, if you're going to deploy to Raqqa or to Libya or to Hong Kong, like, how do you approach it? Do you sit down or Skype, as a team and say, come up with a plan? Or, how do you
approach those types of situations?
So I think everybody on the panel could answer that, but the short answer is first by scenario assessment, actually understanding what the context is, and then a little bit of forecasting, because we have to understand what the potential is to get worse. No crisis that we've worked on looks exactly like any other crisis, so that sort of modeling how we're going to go about answering questions of fact and doing investigations on ground remotely, that's part of it. And then, of course, there's all the security and other considerations, those sort of advanced preparations. Micah can do work in advance to help with field planning, that sort of thing.
Perfect. Well, maybe, Micah, I guess that's a good segue into you. Could maybe you tell us what remote sensing is as a start?
Yeah, remote sensing is just basically measuring anything from far away. So it's simple. At Amnesty International, we use satellite imagery most often. We also use some other sorts of remote sensing that can detect heat coming off the Earth. So if there's a fire or something, it might be able to detect that. We've been using hotspots a lot. I investigate other types of remote sensing. I basically sit at home and do all this too. So while Donatella is in the field, I'm supporting her from my home in Colorado with my dog. So yes, we use a lot of satellite imagery.
And so maybe you could talk us through an example of how you've used satellite imagery and kind of the added value it has, maybe in the Rakhine State.
Yeah, Rakhine State of Myanmar, if you guys don't know, there's a big event there a few years ago where our researcher based in Bangkok, she was getting reports from the people she knows on the ground that villages were being burned. A lot of human rights organizations were getting like small blippets of WhatsApp messages that things were being burned. And we start looking at satellite imagery and there is nothing that you can see because there's clouds everywhere. And then we begin to start looking at different types of remote sensing, which is the heat hotspots. We begin to see fires kind of popping up in all across the entire state. And then eventually, because more and more data and more satellites are documenting the Earth, we are able to see through some of the holes that entire villages were being completely burned to the ground. And so this was helping us to document systematic abuses throughout an entire large area of land. We were able to combine that with witness testimonies. Of course, you couldn't access Rakhine State, which is the added value of remote sensing is when we can't access anything on the ground, remote sensing allows access. When Donatella can't get into Idlib, I can look at remote sensing and she can talk to people maybe in the camps and align witness testimony with what I'm seeing on the imagery. We're able to document time when an event happened, basically. And with the data now, most events we can document within a week of when the event happened. And so we were able to look at the entire Rakhine State and see, once the clouds cleared a bit more, when these villages had been burned and to what extent. We found one village specifically where the entire Rohingyan side of the village was burned to the ground and the Rakhine side was left intact, which is two different groups there. And so that really pushed us to go to different organizations and point out that this was targeted burning against the Rohingya people. Matt was able to go out to the field and use that fire data and any of the imagery that I was able to see burn villages and try and seek out those people from those villages to get witness testimonies. So this was a flood of information that was coming all at the same time, a very sudden event. So remote sensing is super helpful with that, but it's also helpful for the longer term events because it's constantly being taken. So there's so much value to remote sensing.
Yeah, on that, in terms of the result that that can bring, if I think of like a couple of examples that situations that I worked in recent years, a few years ago, we did an investigation on the destruction of Arab villages in northern Iraq. And short of being there and seeing it, there were multiple actors operating at the time. So we could document the destruction. We could work with what people told us and other bits of material evidence on the ground, but actually what nailed it in terms of having of absolute evidence of who the perpetrators had been was the satellite imagery that told us when that destruction had occurred. So the forces that were in control of the area were alleging that these villages had been destroyed either by ISIS deliberately or in the fighting to remove ISIS from those villages. Actually, what the satellite imagery told us confirmed the testimonies that the residents had given that those villages were destroyed after the forces had taken control of the villages for the purpose of making it impossible for the residents to return. And the same is true in a place like Raqqa, where we were able to establish the exact time when houses were destroyed. And in both of those cases, there were concrete results. So in the case of northern Iraq, the authorities, having denied findings of our investigation when presented with the evidence, agreed to set up an investigation. And we didn't see much from the investigation, but what we saw was that pattern, which had been widespread, stopped. So that was important. And in the case of Raqqa, the US-led coalition, when presented with the evidence, admitted responsibility for last year. It was for all the cases that we had investigated. We've investigated many more since, and we are submitting that evidence to them. But it often really helps to bringing those concrete elements that you could only have if you had witnessed it yourself otherwise.
One of the other things, I guess, or the other tools that's useful when there's a lack of access is open source. Now, Scott, you work on open source information, you work on that to a certain degree. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about what open source is, I suppose, first of all, and then maybe one of the most high-profile examples in the last little while is the killing of, I think, was it two women and two children by Boko Haram? Could you talk us through that?
So, yeah, open source is sort of a term of art. Librarians try to define it pretty well, but the short of it is it's anything that any of us can access without breaking any laws. So, to an extent, remote sensing, information, satellite imagery, any of you can access it. You all can toy with it. It is open source. But what we're seeing certainly is connectivity is reaching places where there haven't traditionally been strong protections for human rights. We're seeing more almost documentary evidence of human rights abuses per se, themselves showing the acts, overt acts coming out. All sorts of challenges around the adversarial environment of research these days and disinformation, misinformation, which is probably another podcast. But, you know, in the case of, are you speaking to Cameroon? Yes, I think actually all of us worked on that because it was so egregious. And if you haven't seen this, good. If you've heard about it, also good. But it was the summarily executing of two women and their children by counterinsurgency forces in Cameroon. In order to actually come to that conclusion was no small task. It took everybody bringing their expertise to bear, including, you know, being able to actually confirm that these were Cameroonian soldiers as opposed to the many potential armed opposition groups or armed groups it could have been in West Africa. Eventually, and that was a larger community effort, we were able to pinpoint location, you know, a network of people working on open source intelligence to actually figure these things out. And again, that's another plug for the DBC. And to be able to actually definitively say the who, what, and where of something so egregious. But, you know, another great example of use of remote sensing for me and open source information in general is Amnesty's first use was, or widespread use, was in the case of Darfur. And it was cited in the application for an arrest warrant for the now deposed Omar al-Bashir as a basis to issue the arrest warrant. So these are, all of this open source information is increasingly important to holding perpetrators to account.
Richard, shift our hand to you. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about how the environment fits into Amnesty's work, whether it's a new thing, and kind of how it fits into the whole team, I guess.
Yeah, sure, thanks. It's a great question. So I work on environmental crises. That's obviously not intuitively an area that human rights organizations work across. And many people, including many of my colleagues, will sort of go, oh, what is, well, yeah, great, that sounds interesting. And leave it at that. It's sort of, it's not clear what it is until you actually see it, right? Until you actually sort of have an example and you go, oh, that's what an environmental crisis is. And that's why the crisis response team works on it. So I spent a lot of this year working in Brazil.
And Brazil came to the world's attention in July, August, September of this year with the extraordinary fires in the Amazon, right? And during those weeks where there was intense media pressure, I was doing lots of interviews each day, and almost every interview started with the same question, which was, so how many of these fires are deliberately lit? Right? Is that like how? What is it? Where is this coming from? And the answer, I mean, the first time I heard it was like, wow. Well, all of them, right? It's rainforest. Like tropical rainforest doesn't spontaneously catch on fire. I actually said that on live and I was like on TV, and I'll find out a smoother way of saying it. But it was such a shocking question the first time I had it. Was that like the penny hadn't dropped? This is a sort of a crisis that's been brought on by government policies. And so Bolsonaro, the president of Brazil, did two things in just in a few months that he's been the leader of Brazil. Firstly, he encouraged the productive use of the Amazon. And he essentially said, you know, the Amazon is, quote, open for business. Now, what that does is essentially send a subliminal message to all of the people who would like the land in the Amazon that they can go and take it. Right. So he was sending, I mean, at the same time, he was repeatedly denigrating indigenous people who live in the Amazon and sending that side of the message as well. But he was essentially saying the Amazon's open for business. And the second thing he did was to undermine the government protective function of the Amazon. So the Brazilian state patrols the Amazon. It has agents who will go out there and try and stop illegal logging, illegal land grabs, try and keep natural reserves and indigenous territories safe. But under Bolsonaro, the money has gone away. The patrols have decreased to the extent that, you know, when I was there in February, what the indigenous people were doing was beginning to patrol their own land. Right. They were replacing the government patrols with this is literally like four or five guys. They've got bows and arrows. It's their land. So they're quite stubborn people. They're going to go out and they're going to try and find the illegal land grabbers. That's a sort of a recipe for conflicts, particularly when the people they're looking for are organized crime, heavily armed, often drunk, and know that they're doing something profoundly illegal. So those that potential clashes was something that we were trying to monitor early on in the year. So clearly, this is a sort of a crisis that's been brought on by the rhetoric and the policies of the Brazilian state. It's not a surprise that this has happened. There's a history here. Obviously, the deforestation has been happening for many, for decades in Brazil. But there was something new under Bolsonaro. There was something new on the ground. The indigenous people we worked across five indigenous populations, territories, different peoples as well. And what we're trying to do is sort of get their sense of like what is new on the ground. What does that feel like? And then we'd be talking about an uptick in threats. Even this is like a couple of months into Bolsonaro's presidency. They'd be talking about how the illegal land grabs, they would move closer to the villages. So in the past years, they may have been far away inside the forest, but now you could actually hear the chainsaws from the village. They'd be talking about how in the past they might move around at night. But this year, under Bolsonaro, who's their president, he's got their back, now they're doing it openly during the day. They'd be talking about how there was acts of intimidation, like firing gunfire at night to try and sort of send this subliminal message to the indigenous population that it's no longer safe. It's no longer safe, even though they're on their own clearly demarcated territories. So we were trying to track that and sort of pick that up early. And then the question is, well, okay, so from a human rights point of view, what is that? What's going on there? So you're taking sort of traditional human rights and you're applying them to a relatively new area. Obviously, with the death threat and the intimidation, we were documenting death threats against indigenous leaders as well. Obviously, that's sort of classic human rights, right? Everyone gets that, you know, death threats, acts of intimidation, acts of violence, and obviously tipping over into violence. You know, there are civil and political rights violations clearly triggered. But also when the fires came, the expanse of the conversation, particularly in human rights terms, opened up. It's now about the clear, willful destruction of forest. And in Brazil, in the Amazon, the forest is not like a forest in many other parts of the world. The Amazon is populated. It's a heavily populated place. People live in the forest. It's people's homes that are going up in flames because people will either live in the forest or depend upon it for their livelihoods. And also, I'd say, culturally and spiritually, it's a point of reference for them. So now you're getting far more into economic, social, cultural rights. These sorts of issues. And all of that is under threat. And I think Brazil is one of those areas where, from Amnesty, we take a traditional lens of civil and political rights, threats against indigenous leaders, threats against indigenous communities. And then when you see the broader context of the Amazon itself going up in flames, then it becomes clear, okay, this is actually a human rights crisis across the spectrum of rights. And so, you know, the Amazon was in flames, and Amnesty was well placed when the fires eventually came, because there's a burning season each year, to sort of say, look, there is a clear obligation, international human rights law, its own constitution, to protect indigenous lands and environmentally protected areas, because obviously indigenous people are also living in environmentally protected areas. You know, Brazil was an absolute crisis this year. It was horrifying to see. There was one good thing about it, is that people realized how deranged the Brazilian president is and how dangerous that is at a global level. The problem is that people, you know, need to appreciate is that we've just had the first three quarters of a year of Bolsonaro. But we've got to work out a plan for surviving Bolsonaro over potentially the rest of his period in office, another 4 years, and potentially another 5 years after that. And that's why moving forward, we're sort of like trying to pull back, obviously keeping the pressure on this traditional human rights obligations on the Brazilian state, but having a plan to actually try and track some of the economic pressures behind the destruction. Because Bolsonaro is opening the Amazon for business. So the next challenge is to ensure that no business is able to profit from that destruction, and that we seek to hold to account any business that seeks to profit from Bolsonaro's destruction. It's an example of what we mean when we say, you know, this is crisis work in an environmental context.
And do you work primarily on crisis work in an environmental context? Or do you also look at the broader kind of environmental issues, if that question makes any sense?
Yeah, I mean, I think it does. I mean, so environmental defenders is obviously one of those clear, obvious areas where a traditional human rights organization has a large amount of work. I also think there's newer trends that we should start to pick up. So a lot of my colleagues, as you've heard, work in conflict settings. And what we'll see over time, what we see already, and what we will see more of in the future, is the interplay between environmental factors and conflict factors. In other words, as resources, environmental resources become scarcer, perhaps, for example, because water in the context of climate change in the Middle East, you will see a higher strategic importance for those resources. Water becomes more strategic. And as it becomes more strategic, you will see it play an increasing role. It already plays a role, but you will see it play an increasing role in conflict. For example, we should anticipate more attacks on water infrastructure as a way of getting at the civilian population. Right? So it's a traditional conflict setting, but it's one of those trends that we already know that water can be weaponized in conflict. And so one of the pieces of work we did was in Iraq, looking at Islamic State's deliberate targeting of irrigation wells in a particular part of Iraq, which is incredibly dry, subsistence farmers. And if you can take out a well, if you can sabotage a well, you ensure that the civilian population has no livelihood to come back to. It's a form of a scorched earth tactic.
So I have a couple of questions for the whole panel related to effective advocacy. Before I do, I want to flip back to Donatella. And I was wondering, particularly in a conflict setting, how you go about access and establishing relationships with different actors, you know, and negotiating kind of the contours of, you know, what can be a very dynamic situation.
Yes. Access depends on whether we're allowed in or not. And there are places, you know, that can vary. You know, we can have access to a place at a time and not at another. We're just seeing a situation in the northeast of Syria where I went many times over the last couple of years, and where it looks as though we will not be able to go back for some time because the Syrian government is taking control of that area and we don't get access. Syrian government does not give us access to the areas that it controls. There are times when the situation warrants it and the security situation allows it, where we can also go to places without the agreement of the party that controls the area. But those are exceptions rather than the rule. Now, obviously, Amnesty has been working in every country of the world in one way or another for a very, very long time. So there is no place where we have no contacts. Having said that, when a new situation breaks out, for example, when a new armed conflict breaks out, the previous network of contact, when perhaps our focus was working on people who were detained, ill-treated, and so on, those either go out of play because they leave the country, because they get detained, or simply because they get overtaken by event. Armed conflict breaks out. the players are different. It's not the lawyers with whom we were interacting about prisoners and torture and other issues are no longer the ones that we need to interact with. And so it's a question of then developing new network that are, you know, the people that we need to deal with, both in terms of seeking out victims and survivors, but also building channels of communications with perpetrators, with those who control different parts of the territory. And that, in those cases, has to be done quickly and in less than ideal situation, because in situations where there is polarization, where there are difficulties in communications, and of course, you know, the degree of success in getting access and so varies from place to place and from time to time.
So Scott says that we're a multidisciplinary team, and I said that we all have a superpower, and Donatella's superpower is, among other things, that she speaks 27 languages and has the personal mobile phone number for every warlord in the Middle East. But it's all about that access. So, like, it's amazing to me, we had talked a little bit before about whether people will talk to you. I think that's also true on like an armed group level, where every group wants to show off what the other side is being done to them and how terrible it is. And so there is like a being able to talk your way into that situation is something that, you know, Donatella does very well. So lets us get places that nobody else gets to.
That's my memory of Donatella. Too. Her suddenly turning up in Gaza one day. It's like, oh, how did you get here? So this is a really difficult question. I apologize for asking it. It's difficult because I don't think there's a clear answer. But your thoughts on what you think makes effective advocacy and what you think we need to take into consideration going forward in order to make the best case possible.
Can I just say two words?
Yeah.
Good, verified, factual, rock-solid information.
Good at access, not maths.
And well-presented, concise, and engaging. Otherwise, you've got great information and it's sending people to sleep.
So I have a question then. I think over the last 20 years, not speaking with respect to specific organizations, because there's always exceptions, but the process of human rights documentation has changed quite a bit. Before, you know, we were very heavily reliant on investigators going to the field and doing interviews. Now it seems with a lot more human rights organizations, we have military experts, we have open source, a remote sensing. Do you think that has been a positive for advocacy, or has it, you know, undermined other advocacy efforts?
So it certainly helped, and not as though we're living in a static environment. And as people get more access to information, you have to add something that people cannot find out themselves. People obviously can't get to a place like Rocket and do the interviews themselves, but bringing a specificity of findings of fact that aren't available through other means is the added value. I think the only requirement is that you have strategic thinking, and I mean that in the game theoretic sense, where you're actually planning out who has the agency to intervene in a situation, who can impose costs. That's changing, and looking forward, and again, thinking about the misinformation, disinformation environment, I think that's going to make advocacy more difficult, but it's not something that we and others won't innovate around.
I'd say two things. I think stubbornness has always been absolutely essential to advocacy. You often hear in the current political environment, like, how possibly would we have traction with the Donald Trumps, the Bolsonaros, Boris Johnson of the world? And I get that. I get that there's something new. I get that they're populist leaders. I get that the capacity to shame has changed. But I also think, you know, we don't give up on that. Again, just a reflection on Brazil. Everyone said, like, how on earth do you have any effect, any advocacy impact on Brazil? The reality is Bolsonaro only sent in the army to fight the fires because it became an international scandal. He is absolutely susceptible to international pressure. He'll never admit it. You'll never see a public concession on that point. But the actions on the ground speak differently. And so I would say on that, you know, even in the new era of populist leaders and autocrats, etc., we don't give up on the traditional approaches. And then the second thing, as I mentioned before, I think we need a long-term strategy. I think there has to be flexibility as well.
And so that involves creative thinking and working out, okay, so if over time our capacity to shame Bolsonaro over 9 years is going to diminish over time, what do we do about that? And I think you have to then look for other advocacy targets, non-traditional advocacy targets, and change your research, plan your research to go for those new targets. And if that means going after, in conflict settings, non-state actors, that means going after NSAs. If it means going in Brazil's case, if it means going after the companies that may seek to profit, then we go after the companies. We design the research to go there, because if Bolsonaro's not listening, well, maybe the very, very rich businessmen around him will start to listen once, if we can have impacts on their bottom line. I'm not saying it's a foolproof strategy, but I am saying that you need to be flexible and innovative in terms of work on two tacks at the same time, change direction if you think you're having no traction, and plan out in advance.
Maybe Donatella would ask you to talk a little bit about tailoring the advocacy.
Defining the target, direct perpetrators who may be government or non-state actors. A parenthesis here is that perhaps with the exception of ISIS, which has been a sort of the Islamic State group in recent years, where a change from previous situation, because no interaction was direct interaction was really possible other than from in the very, very early stages. But then the only interaction possible was that they would either kidnap or kill you, so that was not really an option anymore. But otherwise, previously, like all armed groups, there has always been some possibility of engagement, however small, either directly or indirectly. ISIS was really pretty much the one exception where no other party in the world would, admit to being an influencer of ISIS. But otherwise, there are possibilities to engage and to bring pressure to bear on government and non-state actor directly or via those who support them in one way or another. The same is true for companies. I mean, you may try and, name and shame and document what companies do, but you can also try and get to them via their shareholders. You can become a shareholder and then, you can go to the annual general meeting and make your voices. There are many different ways. There are other bodies. There are like UN mechanisms, UN bodies who sometimes are not doing quite as much as they could and should be doing. And we, gear our demands and our pressure to make them move. So yeah, defining the targets and see what you can get out of that target at that particular time, and then honing in on that and having a strategy.
So I'm not sure how to frame this question, but it's primarily for Brian and Micah. But I guess the way I've been thinking about it is that your type of work must be really, really strong for advocacy, in the sense that when you get the type of, Donatella mentioned the importance of verified strong evidence. And I would imagine that the type of work you do, when you hit it right, or when you're lucky, I guess, it's relatively irrefutable. Here's a village that's been burned. Here's a part of ammunition that definitely links to this. And so it's a really strong thing. And I think we see that a lot in open source information as well. It allows us to do what you were talking about, I guess, in terms of telling the story. Not just saying you're all terrible human rights abusers, very bold, but rather to talk us and walk us through a situation and show what happened. But do you think that there's a danger then that human rights advocacy gets drawn towards the types of violations amenable to remote sensing, open source weapons, and away from things that are less sexy, I guess is one word, or I was going to say less technologically involved, I don't know.
I mean, you can apply, I guess I would say specifically to your last thing, I guess I'm not worried that those techniques are going to only be used in certain things, because you can use the satellite imagery for all sorts of social and cultural rights that are not my expertise, but if it's forced evictions, or if it's, I don't know, if you're trying to see if indigenous languages are not being taught in school or whatever else, there's lots of ways to use photos and videos and open source everything else to prove those cases as well. So like the technique doesn't only have to go with one particular thing. Something you said though in there was really important, and that was about getting your message out and how you get it out. And I agree completely with Donatella about, I think the stronger the case, the more effective you can be. But I think something else that we're doing and we're really conscious of on this team is that it's not just about making the strongest case possible to this key diplomat or this key leader. We also are trying to always reach new audiences. Mm-hmm. We're always trying to educate new people. It's harder to tie specific impact sometimes to that, but I think there's real value in teaching people about human rights issues that otherwise would not interact with that. And so our team is always making, it's not just making videos or a podcast or whatever else, but it's like, you know, really appealing visualizations of our data. Somalia work that we did earlier this year, Connor, who leads our media and outreach and communication strategies, had this idea. There he is. You know, we made a graphic novel out of the results of our Somalia work. And that graphic novel has been translated into, I don't know how many languages now, and has spread all over to the point where, like, the week our report came out, my son, who's 15 at the time, comes up to me and he's like, "Dad, your report's on Snapchat because like a video of the novel had appeared on whatever breaking news thing." And he watched, he's like, "Oh, I guess that's what you've been doing the last 6 months." You know, like there's, okay, so if that is appearing on Snapchat somehow, the value or the one strength of Amnesty is we have people everywhere. We can get things in lots of languages. We can get them all over the world. And to tie back to what Richard said, you know, the international outcry over the Amazon, well, if it's truly international, it's because we've educated and reached people in a truly international way.
I was just saying that, like, sometime it is also trying to look at different angles. So something that came out of the work on Raqqa was sort of like an interesting engagement with architects to explore how architecture and urban planning can act as a driver of a conflict where communities are alienated, badly served, and we saw that, for example, in the areas, not just the particular areas that was the subject of this project, but pretty much everywhere else in Syria where the protests then morphed into armed conflict. Those were the poorest, worst served areas. So, you know, pre-conflict, how architecture and urban planning can act as a driver to the conflict, and after the conflict, how architecture and urban planning can work to repair the tears that have occurred in the social tissue, or it can work in the opposite direction, you know, real estate speculation, punitive reconstruction that further alienate and banishes, you know, those people who were the troublemakers. And so, you know, we kind of looked at part of that conflict through a different lens, you know, and that kind of like engaged a different audience. And, you know, and the same is true with the way we present our findings and our information in a way that can engage different audiences.
So you're all obviously at university and you're all obviously studying.
This is those investigative skills.
got it down. And I would say two things about that. I would say that that's obviously a collection of a vast amount of very, very useful knowledge that will serve you well for the rest of your lives. I would also say that you will have to spend your lives unlearning how to talk about human rights. If I try and communicate with the public in a way that I'm writing for a submission to a UN treaty body, it doesn't work. It never works. It's a different language. It's foreign. And so there are two pieces of advice I would give for sort of that broader communication, the point that was made before, the broader communication. How do you communicate to the rest of the public? How do you broaden out that audience? Two things. Firstly, pick a relative who's not in your area. And imagine that over Christmas dinner or Easter barbecue or whenever it is, you have to explain what you're doing and why it's wrong. But it's still assuming an absolute interest in the issue and a capacity to understand. But you've got to write and speak and be able to communicate those sorts of issues and not talk about how this is a violation of the right to so-and-so and it's the obligation on the government to protect and fulfill and respect this particular right under Article 37 of the... Don't do that. But do try and communicate why it's important and in simple terms. And the other thing I would say in terms of communicating to a broader public and making sure that your message lands is if it's landed with you in your work, if that it lingers inside you, use that and assume that it will also land with other people.
So often a really good question to ask yourself is, from this research, what's stuck? What's stuck with me? What's the one interview at the end of your research mission or piece of research or whatever you're doing that's still there, that you can still, it's still visceral, you can still feel it, you can still hear it, you can still think about it, it keeps you, it stays in your mind and you're fresh. And so Brazil, there was one conversation with one particular mother who was about 20 years old, who was in her own home, and she was talking about the difficulty of trying to put her children to sleep, and she couldn't put them to sleep because of the gunfire from the land grabbers. And she was talking about how over time she managed to put her children to sleep, but she couldn't sleep. And that human impact, and you're there and you're writing it down, you're writing, you're getting the information, you're getting the story, but at the end of the essay you know it's landed inside, deep inside, and you know that months later when you're visiting Essex University you'll be talking about it. But my point is that when it touches you in that emotional way, you can use that skill in terms of how you communicate and assume that it will land as effectively with your audience as it's landed with you.
So just to try and end on a feel-good note, I guess, because times are hard and it's late in the day. If there was a piece of advice you could give yourself when you were starting out on your human rights career, what would it be?
I guess I would say put yourself in uncomfortable situations and ask a lot of questions.
I think that realistic objectives, go out of your comfort zones, but also have realistic objectives. Yeah, I mean, we're probably, none of us individually and not all of us together, we're not gonna stop some of the things that we would like not to happen, and we're not gonna get all the successes that we want. But it's always, if you weren't doing it, if nobody was keeping scrutiny, if nobody was putting pressure, how much worse the situation would be. So, you know, the work that you'll do in different, you know, whatever capacities is not gonna be wasted if you don't get your ultimate, you know, you're not gonna succeed in your ultimate goals every time, because it's not going to happen in our business, basically.
So my superpower, and I've actually developed this over time, is taking research missions to beautiful parts of the world. And I say that sitting next to Donatella. It took me a while to sort of build up that sort of like, no, I'm only going here and going, only going here. I'm kind of lucky like that. I've done my hard time in other parts of it. But there's a world of gap between Brazil and Raqqa, between the Solomon Islands and Libya. And that's my superpower. But I think that's only partially the answer. I think the true part of that answer is that you have to find ways to enjoy the work, and that it has to be sustainable over time, and that has to be something that is fulfilling and satisfying about the work in order for you to continue over decades.
Thank you for listening to this episode of RightsCast from the University of Essex Human Rights Centre. You can subscribe and find more of our episodes on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can follow the Human Rights Centre blog at hrcessex.wordpress.com. We'll be back soon with more regular episodes.